Okay, so last lecture of Unit C on learning and cognition before we go into Unit D next week on communication. So the reading assignment, the perusal reading assignment, as well as the a comprehension exercise are due this Sunday. I'm just trying to get my mouse back here. If I can get it refocused. There we go, I think. Yeah, all right, there we go. So so the perusal assignment, the reading assignment, that's on the learning example in those squirrels, the ground squirrels, and the caching behavior. So shows you a variety of different ways that you can investigate that and try to tease apart different hypotheses about whether they're actually learning or whether they're using cues from the environment or whether they're just searching randomly. And then that comprehension assignment is due Sunday, but I extended the availability window, I think till Tuesday night, just because I didn't have it available quite as soon as I wanted it to be. The perusal assignment for Unit D for communication, that reading assignment's already available. And you're free to start on that. That's on crickets and different communication strategies they use and how they change based on density and so on. Then the timeline here. So there's today, and I've kind of separated these up kind of by weeks. So next week will be two-thirds of communication. The week after next week will be communication half the week, and then Thursday will be the midterm review where you can bring your questions, or if there are no questions, I'll work through kind of the greatest hit slides from these units up here. And then the week after that, that's the stage one midterm and the stage two midterm. So as a reminder, the stage one midterm is an individual midterm. It will be available on Canvas. You can come to class and work with your computer here if you like during that time period. Otherwise, you'll have the whole day, and whenever you start it, you'll have 90 minutes after that point to finish it. It's closed book, closed notes. You do get a page double-sided of notes, work with again individually. But then on Thursday of that week, then you come back and you can come into this room. I'll be here if you want to work together, but you don't have to. It's another sort of setup like that where it's not timed at that point. You just have to submit it by the end of the day. I'll get to your question in a second. And you can work with anybody who's enrolled in the class. You can work with your notes. You can work with Canvas. You can work with the book. And it'll be the exact same test from Tuesday. But your total score for the midterm that goes into the midterm category on the syllabus will be 80% stage one and 20% stage two. Question? Right. No, well, stage one's completely individual, no sharing. Well, I mean, how you build that note page, as long as it's hand produced, I mean, you could work behind the scenes and work together, but by hand produced, I mean, I don't want screen captures from the textbook or something like that. Yeah. Yeah, it could be electronic. That's fine. Yeah, like it could be typed. It could be done in GoodNotes or whatever note-taking app that you want. All of that's fine, but it just has to be in a form where you can just have that notes page front and back, so that and if you're taking it at home, then that'll be like you show the camera or something the notes page, then that's it. Or taking it anywhere else doesn't have to be at home. Any other questions? Oh, I'm sorry. They aren't. I'm sorry. Like I said, when I walked in, is that I didn't have a chance to upload these today, and so I will upload them right after class. So I apologize for that. Do my best, but sometimes they just come hot off the presses. Okay. So there's the motivation for this cognition slide is, or for this cognition unit is in itself. The motivation for animals. And so, what motivates animals to do behaviors? And so, this is something that goes back beyond our modern idea of cognitive science. It goes back to sort of early ethology. People wondered about the motivation of animals, and we still use some of those terms from those early ethologists now. So, as an example here, this is kind of a cartoon of an elephant in must, which is a behavior that elephants will often get into during or right before the reproductive season. If you were to look up a definition of must, it's a periodic state of a male elephant characterized especially by aggressive behavior and usually connected with the rutting season, so the mating season. And it's they're just aggressions going everywhere. They will, inanimate objects they'll destroy. They're very, very dangerous. Elephant handlers have a real, real problems with this. They will attack each other. They're Because of that, there can be asynchrony in the must cycles where you can actually get sort of younger elephants that don't must at all, weaker elephants at try, even though they musting at the same time might be more likely to find the female, might more line up with the reproductive cycles there. Musting at the same time, larger, more aggressive males puts them in danger. So they can create an asynchrony where even though you might go, start your reproductive cycles late, it still is maybe safer. And so, so people, ask questions for these sorts of things. What is the kind of, motivation? Why is there's suddenly this activity that isn't directly related to what seems to be the important activity for mating season, actual reproduction, mating, because it doesn't appear like there's signaling or anything else that's going on here. It's just this sort of rampant activity that's happening around the same time. And so, this idea of, must is now what people call a redirected behavior. So this term is a direction of a behavior toward a third party or inanimate object. So the idea is that the elephant would be reproducing, but when it's not reproducing, it's for some reason redirecting this sort of, and we're going to get into, where this comes from, kind of the behavioral drive toward another behavior, possibly an irrelevant behavior. So that's what we mean by a redirected behavior. And so, must is thought to be a redirected reproductive energy. And like I said, elephants in the state can be very dangerous. And so that's kind of, one example people are trying to think about that was one of the frameworks that sort of came up as this idea of, well, you can have this like this effort that goes into these other behaviors that is sort of redirected from the behavior the animal wants to do. And similar to that, we can look at like preening behaviors in animals. So there's a bunch of animals that will direct a lot of behavior toward themselves. They can groom themselves, sometimes excessively. And this can be sort of triggered by certain events around them. So, for example, lower ranking animals in social hierarchies tend to self-groom more often than higher ranking individuals. It doesn't appear that the lower ranking individuals are like dirtier than the higher ranking individuals. There's something else going on that there's this tendency that the lower ranking individuals tend to self-groom in excess over the higher ranking individuals. And and there are these ideas of conflict. And so if you have an animal that is suddenly faced with a conflict between and this sort of approach flee responses where there is something that is potentially interesting but also potentially dangerous, then you see animals that will engage in these behaviors. Animals that will be They'll hang out by their mother and suddenly get an opportunity to mingle and play with other animals, will suddenly get stuck. And then they start, grooming themselves and doing these other behaviors that appear to be due to this conflict. And humans get in this as well. Shy humans at a party, might start touching their hair or their face when they start noticing someone who is attractive to them, but they aren't sure how to approach. And so suddenly there is this nervous behavior of kind of this additional behavior here. We think of these as so-called displacement behaviors. So their behavior is performed in an irrelevant task when the desired behavior cannot be completed, often because there's two conflicts or maybe two different behaviors that need to happen. Like I need to run away from this thing, or I'm attracted to this thing. Like you might see like a dog might encounter a statue that it's never seen before. And it starts jumping in place because it wants to interact with the statue, but it's also a little bit weird. And it doesn't make sense why the dog is jumping around while staring at the statue. That's what people would bin into this displacement behavior. The dog wants to do one of these other two things it can't, so it ends up doing this other irrelevant thing in between. And those displacement behaviors sometimes turn into these repetitive stereotyped behaviors. So excessive grooming continuously, these are sort of pathologically repetitive. So it can be to the point where it actually can cause self-harm. So when you've got a displacement behavior that is a so-called self-directed behavior that is so excessive that it actually does harm to the animal, then applied animal behaviors actually look for these as cues that there's something wrong, that they need to step in and resolve that. So if you are, you know, you might have a zoo that employs a behaviorist, an applied a behaviorist, and they look for things like, oh, this animal is pulling out all its feathers, or it's pulling out all its fur, what's going on there? And they might use this framework of a displacement behavior that, oh, the animal would really like to engage in play or engage in some sort of enriching activity, doesn't have those enriching activities, and so is stuck displacing that motivational energy into another behavior. And so then the applied behaviorists might suggest, well, then that's the reason why we might actually throw in toys into a particular habitat or an enclosure, or provide additional space, and so on and so forth. This is all driven by these old ideas of displacement behavior, that somehow behaviors that can't be, that with desired behaviors that can't happen, lead to irrelevant behaviors happening instead. And so if you can manage to figure out what the desired behavior are or resolve the conflict, you can get rid of the potentially harmful displacement behavior. That's kind of this idea behind these sorts of motivations here. So all of these are kind of related to each other. But, you know, it's, you kind of wonder, like, you know, where does all this come from? And so the idea that all of this comes from was so-called drive theory or motivation theory. And again, this is an idea that came from folks like von Uxkull, the guy who came up with the Umwelt and the tick. Those times when, you know, if you think about the notion of the Umwelt, it was all about, like, let's try to get inside an animal's head and figure out the sensory experience. And then that kind of drifted onto thinking about what could be motivating that animal. And these early theories of drive theory predicted, you know, used these hydraulic models. They didn't actually think that there was a reservoir of liquid in the brain of the animal, but they said it kind of behaves as if there's this energy that accumulates in a big vat inside the animal, and it can come out through a bunch of different spots. It can either be open or closed. And so energy is drained by doing those activities. And if the activities are prevented from being done, it causes the energy not to get displaced. And potentially, if it's modeled like this, if let's say you've got motivational energy coming in, if you've got an outlet for that energy down here that normally pulls out all of that motivational liquid, then if that gets blocked off, then you get an accumulation and suddenly these other behaviors start happening instead. And so that was this idea of drive theory, is that, like, we can think about all these displacement behaviors and so on as a result of some sort of metaphorical hydraulic process going on in the head of the animal. And so, you know, that's fine. And, you know, it's maybe a nice conceptual model, a nice mental model for, again, for the applied behaviorists, but it can be kind of problematic when you start thinking about the biology, because then you say, well, where is this in the brain? You know, like, where are these little reservoirs? And for a long time, so folks like Skinner responded to this saying, we got to get rid of this thinking and we need to focus just on things we can observe. And that's, you know, where we got behaviorism and Skinner boxes and conditioning and all of that. That was largely a rejection of these types of drive theory kind of ideas. But then, as we'll talk about here in a second, There was a renewed interest later, motivated, you know, in part through psychology, and to create this new form of what we call cognitive science where we separate the mind and the body. And this idea, once you have a mind that's separate from the body, then you're not constrained to actually looking for mechanisms that implement that mind. You're allowed to sort of come up with new mechanisms that actually aren't mechanical. They're mechanisms that are phenomenological, they're fictitious, they're metaphorical, just like these old drive theories, but they seem to better explain interesting behaviors that you observe that without these internal states, you just don't have a great a chance of wrapping your kind of your arms around. And so this separation of the mind and body, like I said, is what gave us what today we call cognitive science. Cognitive psychology, cognitive neuroscience, I'll talk about it here in a second. And so, as I said, Skinner was largely reacting to we got to get rid of this stuff from drive theory and focus just on things we can observe. And the body is sort of, just on things that are the physical interface, like the body here, between learning and conditioning. So, with Skinner, it was like, I'm not interested in whatever's going on inside the brain, I can't observe that. But I do know that when I give a reward over and over again, I gradually change a behavior. And that tells me about the learning ability of the animal. But that's all things that I can assess from outside the animal. And I don't need to assert that there's certain things going on inside the animal that are unobservable. To Skinner, everything you can learn about an animal should be something you can observe about the animal. But then you got this linguist, Noam Chomsky, who came who enters, and he writes a scathing review of Skinner's work. And Chomsky, who studies how humans use language, talks about how there is no way in Chomsky's mind, and I guess in his argument in your mind too, there's no way that you could get language through the process of conditioning, operant or classical, that language requires mental states. There's no way to come up with words and concepts that you can use and to train something semantically to use these words without those things having both the stuff that comes from behaviorism and internal mental states. And so with that sort of kicked off this new quest to look for models that were unencumbered by having to be observed or linked to physical, biological, material reality. So these are things that are phenomenological models. These are models that we're saying that they're saying they're not that they know exactly where they live in the head, but they said that, we're just taking for granted that there is something that implements these things. And if we assume that these things exist, we will have a much easier time explaining complex behaviors that we see in nature. And Chomsky was, mainly focused on humans, but it was also sort of thinking about, other forms of nature and also implying what types of things you might not ever expect in non-humans, because maybe those non-humans were better. He would sort of say maybe better deserving of Skinner's approaches and maybe everything that you can do in the non-humans, you can use behaviorism for. But for humans, in order to understand humans, you have to have mental states. So that's kind of the beginning of cognitive science and cognition. So when we talk about cognition, sort of a short definition of cognition is the ability of an animal to separate itself from the moment. So that's what I mean by mental states. It can kind of escape into its head, and its head can change while the world stays the same. And in which case it is living and able to contemplate past, predict the future, and act accordingly. To the cognitive sciences, thinking is almost separate than behavior. Behavior is the thing you observe, and thinking is a parallel process that influences behavior. And so, this is an unobservable process, and a thinking mind, a cognitive mind, can be aware of itself. It can be aware of others. It can be aware of the awareness of others. It can forecast the future. It can solve problems. It can have emotions. It can have these mental states that are the only, like, what is sadness? Well, sadness is purely a driver of behavior. So that's the kind of thought here, is that it is there's things that can exist entirely inside the cognitive world that are meant to drive behavior, but are not meant to necessarily link to something physical in the physical world. You can be empathetic, you can be aware of others' emotions, and then you can have intuition and insight. So insight, what do we mean by insight? Well, that's like we learned about trial and error learning, where Steller's Jay had to, to try a bunch of things over and over and over again until it found the right thing. Well, what if you could do that trial and error in your head? What if you could avoid having to do the experiment by yourself, and you could just in your head say, "What if I did this? What if I did this? What if I did this?" over and over and over again, and eventually figure out the way to open that box. That's what insight is to a cognitive scientist. So, cognitive science is sort of broken up into it's very interdisciplinary. There's people that probably don't care at all about biology, that care about, AI, getting computers to think and things like that. And so I'm not even listing all of the different folks that are involved, but two that come into contact with this class are underneath cognitive science or cognitive psychology, which is sort of the psychologist's approach to study these mental processes by themselves without having to worry about what goes underneath them. It's just purely, what if we have these mental states? What if we have these mental states? What is a theory of behavior that involves these states but not these states, and so on and so forth, arguing about which mental states better capture observed behaviors in humans. And then there's cognitive neuroscience, which tries to put the body back into it. So if you take for granted that sadness exists, that happiness exists, et cetera, where is the center for sadness in the brain? That's a question from cognitive neuroscience. It links the cognitive ideas to the physical matter once again. And then with that, on the kind of more non-human side of it, we have comparative psychology, where if we assume that these cognitive processes exist inside non-human animals, then how can we do similar studies of them? And so this, for if there's a benefit to studying human behavior using cognition, the comparative psychologists, or sometimes comparative animal psychologists, would argue that there's a benefit for studying animal behavior using these processes. But there are costs, there are risks. And the big worry, and this was a worry back when von Uxkull was talking about drive theory, is of anthropomorphism. So anthropomorphism, the uncritical attribution of human characteristic to non-human animals. I see an animal do something, I think about how I might do that thing, I then assume that the animal is doing it the way I think I'm doing it in my head. You can anthropomorphize yourself. I mean, sometimes I think there are behaviors that we post-hoc can put a story on. We can say, this is why we did that behavior. But in reality, the actual physics of what were the stimulus response relationships that led to that may have had nothing to do with thinking processes, but in retrospect, it seems like they do. So there could be anthropomorphism where you project human potential mental mechanisms onto animals that don't need them. And for that, there was, and this again, this is actually an old principle. This is again back to and more von Uxkull, but it still is of interest to biologists today. Morgan's canon, or the principle of parsimony, is this, and this is just a quote, so it's a little long-winded, but in no case is an animal activity to be interpreted in terms of higher psychological processes if it can be fairly interpreted in terms of processes that stand lower in the scale of psychology, evolution, and development. So the idea here is that if you have a more parsimonious explanation that does not require internal mental states, Morgan's canon or Morgan's principle would say that's the one that if you have no way to tell the difference, you should default to. So why assume mental states if you don't need them? That's what Morgan's principle is there. And so this was largely a response to people's worry about people like von Uxkull talking about anthropomorphism. So that's this kind of like the kind of structure of cognitive science here is these things kind of together. So do we have any questions about I guess, yeah, before we go on to these examples here, do we have any questions about these basic frameworks here? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's a great question. The question was, what's the difference between redirected and displacement behavior? Redirected behavior is often kind of a one for one. So it's like the elephant was motivated to reproduce, but it can't reproduce. So it has all this energy, so it does something else instead. A displacement behavior is often due to a conflict between motivations. I'm motivated to play with my friends, but I'm also motivated to stay within the safety of my mother. And because of that, I don't know what to do. And so I do an irrelevant behavior in between. But the reason I brought up drive theory is in the end, drive theory, motivation theory is actually supposed to be kind of a cognitive theory that unites those together. So you could say, well, we don't really need the semantics. If we just use the hydraulic model can explain both of those sorts of things, where if you don't have the outlet for the mental energy, it then piles up and it either comes out one pathway or it comes out another pathway or something along those lines. So you could draw different hydraulic reservoirs that lead to displacement behavior due to conflict or redirected behavior due to just not being able to do the one thing you want. And the drive theory is supposed to kind of explain all of them. But then the applied animal behaviorists would use those terms to sort of say, oh, that right there, it seems to be a displacement behavior because they're confused about these things, or oh, it's a redirected behavior because they really would like to eat right now and they can't eat because the food is kept away from them, so they're doing this other thing instead, and that sort of thing. Other questions about the sort of foundations here of this cognitive approach? Yeah. Excellent question. Right. So, and I'll mention this right here at the end, but yeah, cognition is, these are hallmarks that we think of as being cognitive, but it is not an exhaustive list. Like problem solving, for example, that's kind of a broad scope. Like, well, what do we just do to define problem solving? So the kind of key thing that links all of these things together is this separation of mind and body and the presence of internal states. So if whatever process you're assuming only makes sense if there's a mechanism that has internal mental states, it's cognitive. If it is just purely based off things you can describe with observables, then it would be behavioral. All right. So this is just meant to be a list of examples of things that have internal mental state. Okay, other questions about this about these frameworks here? So there can be pros and cons to taking this approach. So this is like an example. So there are certain terms that cognitive scientists will often use, or comparative behaviorists will use when describing behaviors that we see. And so, this one of them is mental time travel. So, mental time travel is a term that you hear people talking about when an animal is able to predict and forecast into the future. And I've already hinted at this example in a previous lecture. So, this is a depiction of a veiled octopus. Sorry, a veined octopus, sometimes known as the coconut octopus. And you can find this octopus that taking half shells that have been, these are from, humans breaking coconut shells apart. It will find them and it will then cover itself in them and sort of like a kind of a hermit crab here and hide within the safety of these shells. Now, we don't think that this behavior of using coconut shells is pretty early, right? It's pretty recent because humans haven't been breaking apart coconut shells for that long. But you can also find octopus finding big bivalve shells, clam shells, and doing a similar sort of thing and hiding in those. So they think that this has just been them transferring a behavior that they had that where they were already using kind of, shells that were on the ground, and they turned it into these coconut husks instead, or coconut shells instead. And what I think is particularly interesting is that when these octopi need to move, what they'll do is they'll, like two dinner plates, stack these shells up underneath them, or kind of like two bowls, And then they'll sit on top and drape their legs over and then walk around carrying them underneath. And so people will sometimes talk about, as this is an example, that the octopus, it might be forecasting that it does not need the protection now, but later on it might need the protection. So it's good to bring something protective with it. So this could be an example of mental time travel. But and that's an interesting it's an interesting interpretation. But I think that, though, is that necessarily consistent with this idea that are there sort of a more parsimonious set of explanations that don't require internal states and forecasting? I mean, after all, a hermit crab, no one is, I mean, a hermit crab, that's just they're not, the way you wouldn't, when you see a hermit crab out of its shell, you know that that's, it must be molting or some other thing. That's not the normal case. And it's going to very quickly find a shell and put itself in that shell. And I don't think anyone would say that a hermit crab is doing mental time travel. It's just sort of adapted to live in shells that keep it moist and keep it safe, and they bring the shells along with it. So, what's kind of, different here? So, when you look at this behavior, you could think alternatively, instead of using mental time travel, maybe we should, be splitting this thing up rather than saying that the octopus is thinking about the rationale of bringing shells along with it. Can't we split these things up into functional hypotheses and mechanistic hypotheses? So how, like literally physically, biomechanically, how is it picking these things up? How is it recognizing them? What is it recognizing about them? All of these mechanistic questions about hermit crabs and coconut shells, that's one thing. And then now that we've established that octopus and coconut shells you see them around all the time, then now we can ask a separate why question of, why is it good for them to have the coconut shells around? And really, an octopus with a coconut shell, like I said, to me doesn't seem that different than a hermit crab inside, a mollusk shell. And so that, that it's advantageous for the coconut octopus to carry around coconut shells. And I don't think you need a mental state to tell sort of, or to, for that story. Like, I don't think that is absolutely necessary to explain this behavior. There are explanations for picking the coconut up. There are explanations for why octopi who figured out how to pick the coconut up have hung around, but we don't necessarily have to blend them into a prediction model where all of that rationality that is playing out over natural selection, over evolutionary history, is also playing out over life history inside the octopus's brain. So I'm not saying that octopus isn't doing mental time travel, but I'm saying we have to be very careful that if we assert a hypothesis about behavior that necessarily invokes mental states, is that hypothesis confounding multiple levels of explanation? Because that's something we never want to do. All right, so I think Morgan would say in this case, if you can explain it with separate proximate and ultimate, then do that. Whereas I think it's very tempting to be thinking about something more cognitive going on inside this octopus. Octopus are very intelligent. They do a lot of amazing things. It gives us the impression that if they have cognition, like if any animal has cognition, it seems like an octopus very well could. But is this really the best example of it? I don't know. For me, it's not very convincing. I don't know, but for you. So, any questions about that example? The coconut octopus and whether it's rationally carrying shells around. Okay. So, another example, this actually just came out yesterday, I think, or maybe 2 days ago. So, this is from Lars Chitka's lab. He works on bumblebees and he's very interested in knowing the limits of intelligence in bumblebees. And so, he did, unfortunately, the author here does something that I always tell people not to do, is they put a question in the title. And because it's very provocative, right? Because it's always better to put answers, hypotheses that you've supported or hypotheses that you've rejected in the title, so you kind of know what the paper is about. Here it's kind of cagey, especially when you find out what the answer is. But they want you to think that the answer is that the bumblebees are doing a very highly cognitive thing. And that's what this means in comprehension is, which I'll explain here as we go through this paper. So this is these are bumblebees, and we're going to see videos of them here. So here, what we're going to see once I hit play here is that there's this glass table, and underneath it, there is this little yellow disc that has a hole in it that has sugar water inside the hole. And so if the bumblebee, over after many rounds of training, can learn how to grab that little disc and pull it out and get the sugar water reward. So that's cool, right? Now, the bumblebee can also learn to do that with a piece of string. And this was inspired by similar experiments people do with primates and other sort of vertebrates that we already kind of associate with this type of intelligence. So the bumblebee grabs a string, pulls on the string, eventually gets the sugar water. And what's cool about these bumblebees too, which isn't addressed in this paper, but is addressed in other papers of theirs, is once you teach one bumblebee, it might take a long time for you to teach one bumblebee to do this. When it returns to its colony, its nest mates learn how to do this really fast. And so they also use bumblebees as a model for social learning. So it appears like once some bumblebees learn how to do these tasks, they have the ability to teach that to others. So that's pretty cool too. But anyway, okay, so they got these, you can train them in these different ways. And then the question is then how do you test them? Well, so here's the test. They're going to give them a bunch of different tables like this. So there's one bee and multiple tables. And notice under each table, there is a yellow disc with an intact string and a yellow disc with a cut string. And so when they then test, they then watch, where does the bee go? Does it go to any string or does it only go to the ones that are intact? So you can see this bee here seems to be very interested in this intact string right here. And so we want to go with here. I don't know if it'll come back in this. I think that's the end of that. Oh, there, it's coming back. And so then they can also then count up, where's it going to stop next? So it's searching, it can see through that, and it stops at another intact string. So you can watch videos like this over and over again, and then you can count what proportion of time, every time the bee lands on the table, are they closer to one string or the other, or are they interacting with one string or the other? And you could do this in a wide range of different experiments where, so here they actually did eight different types of experiments meant to tease apart different hypotheses here, where you can see the training is like with or without a string. So there's a string and no string. There's also whether the string is blue or white. There are other training cases where they put tape over top here where you can't see the string through the table. And then there are other cases that like back here where they actually put the edge of the table so the bee doesn't have the ability to back up once they're in. So there's a bunch of different things they're doing. I'm not going to go over why they've done all of this, but then I also want to focus on not just the training case, what they train them up, but then what they test them on. And so, you know, there's some that are just like the ones I just talked about here, disconnected and connected. But there's different ways they're disconnected. So over here, if you look, the disconnected ones actually shifted over a little bit. And then, you know, down here, now they actually, in the paper, they refer to this as being coiled. So I think I actually zoom in here if that helps a little bit here. So in the maybe if yeah. So in the paper they refer to these little things here as the string being coiled up. And so the thought here is that if you coil up the string so that there is sort of this complex maze between where the string is and where it connects, then these breaks are going to be harder to sort of learn just visually. And so if you manage to successfully choose the right one, even though the string is kind of coiled up, then you have a notion of causal relationship or ends and means. So that's really what they're testing here. Do the bees just look at a visual pattern and pull on something that looks like what they got from their training case? Or do they actually, in their training, form a mental model of consequence, of cause and consequence, where if they were, even though they were trained without a coil, they kind of learn that, oh, the idea here is I pull on a string that's connected to the object, and that connection to the object is the thing that, regardless of what the string looks like, if I pull on it, if it's connected, it will eventually come out and I'll be able to get my sugar water reward. So, are they purely doing it based on visual associative cues or on a mental map of consequence, you know, so that it involves those in internal states? And so, we look at results here. And so, across experiments 1 through 6, we can see that in certain training regimes, so when you train them without a string and then you give them the string test, then they go to either string with roughly 50%. So this is, I think these are confident. Well, these are, I think, is the full bar plot here. But I mean, the basic idea here is that the mass of responses, I mean, sometimes they go to one, sometimes they go to the other, but it's basically a 50-50 which one they go to. But on all the rest of these, so experiments 2 through 6, which are summarized down here, they're able to accurately pick the string that's not cut. So that's cool. But then what about these other ones? So in these cases where they train them and they can't see the string, or they use the coiled cases here, they go back to chance. So they, in fact, you know, in this one, it almost looks like they're actually choosing the broken one more often than the fixed one. So based on all of this, they make the conclusion that it's likely the bees are using a combination of image matching and associative learning rather than means end understanding. And then they say these contribute to a deeper understanding of the cognitive processes employed by bumblebees, which is a fancy way to put at the end of your abstract that there are no cognitive processes that have been displayed. So it's all been basic behaviorism, but it was testing a cognitive idea. So the they were following the in the Indian, they said, you know what, it's best we're best assuming there are no psychological states. That's what's explaining this behavior. So they are following Morgan's canon, the law of parsimony here, but they were motivated to do this experiment by thinking about cognition. And that, I think, is something that is very valuable about the cognitive approach, is that sometimes it's less about coming up with answers, but more about coming up with interesting new questions and figuring out if the animals have certain abilities that we maybe don't often observe, and then figuring out how those things work. So sometimes it's less about the causal questions, sometimes it's more about the causal questions than the particular hypotheses. So that's one of the values of cognitive science. It's not just the cognitive hypotheses that might be going on, but it is the new questions that we ask in order to test those cognitive hypotheses that lead us to, I think, down experimental paths that we wouldn't normally have. Okay. So with that, any questions about those examples, about the role of cognition in these experiments? I mean, the octopus case is an experiment, it's just kind of a natural example. All right, so let's do a question of our own then. So, elephant must is an example of which of these from drive theory? Displacement behavior, redirected behavior, self-directed behavior, or stereotyped behavior, otherwise known as repetitive behavior. So just a vocabulary thing. So about half of everybody. So waiting maybe another, let's say 15 seconds. Got almost everybody. Maybe 10 seconds. Five seconds. 1 second. All right, I'm going to go ahead and stop. All right, so 11% or 17% A, 67% B, 13% C, 3% D. So what I was shooting for here was redirected behavior, but it is totally understandable displacement behavior. Again, all these things, I mean, that feel kind of subjective. They're again based on not something that is a real mechanism, but most people group must into a redirected behavior because there's one thing the elephant wants to do, mate. It can't mate. So it does this other thing and it just becomes super hyper aggressive and dangerous to itself and to others. Until finally the mating season goes by. The difference between displacement behavior is displacement behavior typically is associated with a conflict between motivations that leads to doing another behavior. So you actually can do the behaviors in the case of displacement behavior. But because of the conflict, it leads to this relevant behavior. In redirected behavior, you can't do the desired behavior, and so it leads to the new behavior. So any questions about that? All right. Great. Okay, so let's, I mentioned that this cognitive science helps us think through building experiments with other animals and what they can do. And so, one of these examples I like is this mental time travel I've already talked about, a different way that we can assess mental time travel than the coconut example, in this case, in stingless bees. And so there's this assay, time place learning. So this is a common way that you test for mental time travel. So this is assuming a couple of things that the animal has. This chronesthesia, which is the awareness of past and the future and the use of that information in the present, and then also so-called episodic memory. So if you learn there's different types of memory, there's semantic memory, which have to do with sort of remembering language. There's procedural memory, and I'm not going to quiz you on these types of memory, but I do want you to know that one. Procedural memory, which is the memory of how do you do stuff, how do you brush your teeth, how do you walk around, those sorts of things. And then episodic memory. So this is the catalog of experiences in time and in space. So you remember, I was here and this thing happened. That's an episodic memory. I remember this episode of my life at this particular time in this particular space. And so if you have chronesthesia, time, then it's possibly of this episodic memory. And so we then say time place learning. So do you have, this is an example of mental time travel, the ability to associate a reward or behavioral consequence with a specific location in time and use that information to come back in the future? And so we would look for in our experiments, anticipation. And what do I mean by anticipation? That's a change in behavior consistently before any cues of that event will happen. So when Dexter is really hungry, my dog, we usually feed him at 5, consistently at 3:30, he starts placing his head on our lap. So that's anticipation of his food coming up at 5, and then eventually we feed him and he's fine. He starts begging for that. And so is there an equivalent of that in, let's say, stingless bees? So this is a particular type of stingless bees. So stingless bees you find in the tropics. You can find New World and Old World, and these this is Trigona, this particular genus here. They're cool stingless bees because they inhabit, like, they're like honeybees, but they and their entire nests are the size of teacups. And so they exploit a niche that honeybees are too big for, but otherwise do all the sort of same stuff that honeybees do. Because they're so small, their sting has been reduced to basically be nothing, thus stingless bees. So when they defend themselves, they have to come up with all sorts of other ways to defend. And if you ever stand like a big hairy mammal next to a stingless bee colony, they'll grab your hair and pull it. And so you get like a bunch of bees just pulling in every direction. It's a really for me, with my short hair, it's just kind of weird. But for my wife with long hair, it can be painful because you get like strings of them tug of warring on the hair. But anyway, so what I think actually Mike Breed did, Murphy and Breed did with this particular thing is that they had, we went down, I think, into Panama or Costa Rica, and there was a particular spot near a stingless bee colony, but not at the colony, where they presented a feeder at a particular time of day, let's call it noon, every day. And then they just put the feeder out there, and they let it that it would always come out at noon, and then it would stay out there, and gradually bees would find it. And what they found is that over time, after a certain number of days of sort of training, then time zero, that's when the feeder is presented, that's noon, up to 20 minutes before the feeder comes out. And they just are observing at a camera, it's in the back, that the bees don't see any other cues. Like, nobody has arrived 20 minutes beforehand, but bees start showing up 20 minutes beforehand, waiting for that feeder. And then eventually, once the feeder arrives, then you get a rapid rise in the bees, but you always have bees waiting there for the feeder up to 20 minutes ahead of time. Then they said, all right, after we've done all of that, then what we're going to do is then stop bringing the feeder out. And so what was interesting about that is then still 20 minutes beforehand, bees would show up, but then once noon came by and no feeder was around, bees would leave. So this you could draw the conclusion that these bees, at either an individual level or somehow a colony level, I don't know. Who knows what the mechanism is here? It's a difficult thing here, but they do appear to have this time place learning. And if we buy that time place learning is a form of mental time travel, then that suggests that these stingless bees, either collectively or as individuals, are actually able to say, every day at noon, there's food. And so I'm going to be ready before noon. So I'm going to predict that tomorrow at 11:40, I better be there because the food is going to show up at noon. So I think that's kind of interesting. And you might say, why would a bee need time place learning? Well, you can, oh yeah, go ahead. Well, I think that that's a great question. So, like, what's this different than operant conditioning? I would say that the distinction here is that this is a modification of foraging behavior via operant conditioning, but you're now not only involving stimuli that are outside, but you're also involving stimuli that are inside. So the bees can experience the world, the way it smells, the way it looks, but they also can experience a little clock in their head, a circadian rhythm, and they can now integrate information from the outside and the inside in order to form their behaviors. And so the cognitive science doesn't get rid of conditioning, but it adds additional things that can be used as stimuli. And those additional things, those drivers, come from inside the animal. Well, I mean, the feeder is a reward. So if you happen to show up at the right time, you get rewarded. And they are modifying their behavior because these bees would be out searching for flowers, and they're paying the opportunity cost of showing up where the feeder is. And so by doing that, then again, there are juicy flowers that they could be drinking from all over, but they are giving up, they're foregoing that opportunity because they're convinced that there will be an even better feeder right here. Other questions? So time place learning. This is one of the assays we can do. Other things that we can assess in cognitive science is the theory is sort of a self. So once you have this mental process, then one of the things you can think about in your internal states is, how do I fit within the world? And am I an independent thing? Do I recognize that I am me? Like, what is the idea of self? What animal has self versus not having self? So a dog might walk by a mirror and look at in the mirror, and might immediately be freaked out by this other thing that it sees in the mirror, and then over time will habituate to seeing that thing in the mirror. And because it realizes that stimulus is, it sees that stimulus over and over again, and it never has a punishment or reward going with it, so they can might just ignore itself in the mirror. But what if you have an animal like this elephant that when they look in the mirror, you've painted the elephant with a piece of, a little circle of paint on the forehead that the elephant can't see. Or you've put something on the animal that, again, they can't experience in some way. So they've done this with elephants. They've done this with ants, although there's some con that, you know, people don't, there's some issues with how they do it. But like in the case of the ants, the ants have a black cuticle in this particular case. So some ants got black paint that wasn't visible, and some ants got red paint. So the paint is made from the same stuff, so it still smells the same way. But it looks differently. And in that case, and just like in the elephant case, if you have a visually conspicuous addition to your face and you walk by a mirror and you see your reflection in the mirror, to pass the mirror test is to then go and touch where that was added to you. And when you see it in the mirror and then trying to remove it from yourself. So you have an awareness that you exist and you've gained information about yourself by looking at this stimulus that's over here and then figured out that that means I need to direct a behavior towards me. Yeah. That's a great question. So if the response we're looking at is touching the object, if you don't have the ability to touch the object, you say, well, maybe a dog could still maybe get it, but it still could be animals that don't have the ability to interact with that. You might look for other changes in behavior. And if you were able to show that in a control group that maybe had black paint applied, but not red paint, it had that there was no difference in its behavior from a group that had no paint. So you can imagine doing an experiment. I've got a bunch of lobsters with no paint, lobsters with red paint, lobsters with blue paint. And these are maybe red lobsters, not to advertise. But the idea is you have these three different groups, and then you could say, I'm just going to measure movement patterns. It isn't necessarily patterns toward directed toward that spot, it's just movement pattern. If you happen to notice that the lobsters with the paint that matches their so the cuticle or the carapace, if that amount of behavior matches the behavior with those without any, but the one with the conspicuous contrasting color has more of whatever behavior it is, even if it's not directed at that, you could still draw a conclusion that it has an awareness that there's been a modification to itself and it's trying to deal with it.
Nicely.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, normally when you do these types of tests, then there's a video analysis process afterwards. Often, if possible, it's done blind. And so you code up. So we haven't talked about ethograms, but you could sort of have someone code up at any particular moment. Did the elephant turn? Did the elephant raise its? You could list like what are like 15 different actions that an elephant can do at the time scale of every second. And then you could just have someone sit and watch a video and every second say, what action is the elephant doing over and over and over again? So then for every video of the elephants in the control group, you'll have all of those trajectories. And for all of the elephants in the painted group, you'll have all of those trajectories. And then you'll then do stats to say, are there like a t-test? Is there a difference in the mean number of nose flicks in this group versus this group? And it might be you find that. And then afterwards, when you want to actually then help communicate this to others, the stats are not necessarily the most compelling thing. So you'll show them a video that, oh, here's an example video of an elephant that is bringing its tusk up to its head right at that spot. But it might be that the stats that led you there were a little more numerical. But if you really are putting all your money and that's the behavior, then ahead of time when you design your experiment, you say, we're going to count how many times they touch their head exactly in that spot. And then you'll ignore all of the other behaviors. But that might actually, not be great because it might be that the elephant responds to seeing that in a way that isn't actually touching that spot, it's doing something else. That's the mirror test. Supposedly, elephants pass it, ants pass it, individual chimps. There are chimps that pass it and chimps that don't, but the chimps that pass it also do well on other types of cognitive experiments that have to do with predicting the behavior of other chimps. So there was a question a while ago about intelligence and sort of like trying to sort of say across different species, if there's, some that might be faster learners or whatever. And this actually suggests that even within a certain species, the chimps that have an easier time recognizing self also seem to have an easier time recognizing what's going on in the heads of others. And so kind of like general cognitive abilities are higher in some individual chimps than others, even within a species. But that failing the mirror test doesn't necessarily mean that there's no cognition there or no recognition of self. Just because a lobster, doesn't touch its, like it may have no way that it can respond, or it just might not be in the umwelt of the animal that, it just because it doesn't know how to sense that particular addition to its body. It doesn't mean that if you found a way to communicate there was some difference, it wouldn't respond. And so people have tried to build more generalized mirror tests, like the so-called olfactory mirror test here. So, dogs, I think, up until this point, did not pass the visual mirror test. But this paper claims that in an olfactory mirror test, where you make a dog smell different, then it does seem to recognize that it's, it smells different and so on. And so that's kind of what they said is a design of a species relevant test analogous to the mirror test. So that's this idea of umwelt coming back, that you have to sort of understand the umwelt of the animal to design the right mirror test. And then the claim here is that dogs that are altered investigate their own odors longer. But there's a lot of criticism of that stuff too. So it's not a perfect thing. So, this is in the same journal a year later. Gallup and Anderson did a review of all of the mirror tests out there and basically concluded that for all but primates, you could explain the results of those papers using the kind of non-cognitive explanations that they, or in other words, they didn't actually pass the mirror test. Something else was going on. It was an artifact of the experiment, or so on, like that. It was just a badly, poorly designed experiment. And so they claim in 2018 that really, primates are it. Not even elephants are actually passing the mirror test for real. So it's very contentious, but a lot of cognitive things are because there's no mechanism that you can lean on. There's nothing you can prove that there's definitely something there or not there. If you say that my hypothesis is that, that neurons respond in this particular way to this very specific chemical stimulus, you can just test for exactly that. And maybe it's hard to test for that, but eventually you get the lab methods to test for that. And then you can test and think, ah, that's rejected or that's supported. There's a lot more wiggle room here, which leads to a lot more debate for a lot of these cognitive things. The other one that I want to explain, any questions about this? The mirror test stuff? Related to the mirror test, because I mentioned the individuals that do well with the mirror test also do well at predicting others, is the theory of mind. And so, whether an individual can look at other individuals and then have a theory of what's going on in their heads, and then change their response based on what they think those other individuals think. And so, theory of mind, ability to form hypotheses about the thoughts of surrounding animals, and a way that we test for the theory of mind is to look for, and this is one assay, you could do this in many other ways, gaze following. So, what is gaze following? Well, the idea there is that can you get an animal that will direct its attention to an object simply by observing where another animal is looking. That's what we mean by gaze following. So if my dog is standing there, and I'm looking there, and I just keep looking there, I don't interact with the dog at all, and it then goes to the spot where I'm looking and checks it out. That might be an indication that the dog is saying, oh, I have a hypothesis about why he's looking there. He's looking there because there's something interesting there. Rather than me going to him, I'm going to the spot that is causing that behavior. That's what we call theory of mind. And there are some animals that seem to pass the gaze test. So there's chimpanzees seem to do it, and dogs seem to do it. But interestingly, not domestic dogs do, wolves don't. So when a dog grows up with humans, then I think there's GYE questions here, whether it's developmental or genetic. And there are people like Clive Wynne, who's a psychologist here who studies dog behavior and dog-human interactions, and he can speak a lot more to this. So I think there's still some question of that, do dogs learn gaze behavior, or do they have gaze behavior in their genetic differences between them and wolves? But I think wolves don't. Like, if you stare at something, the wolf won't, it just won't pay any attention to what you're staring at. So, maybe if, the dog and the chimp have some notion of theory of mind, they have an idea that there is a mind in another organism, and they use that to make hypotheses about why that other organism is doing what they're doing. All right. So, any questions about the theory of mind? Yeah. It is not, well, we have to have a way to assess it. So we do, the animal needs to do something to make it clear to us that they're changing their behavior based on inferring something from whatever they're observing. But it isn't necessarily that, like, they're going to copy. It's not imitation. It's not like everybody's looking this way, and so then the animal starts looking that way because they want to imitate everyone else. That's imitation learning. That's a different thing. That doesn't require theory of mind. But it's like if I'm standing here and the dog is way over there, and I'm looking at that point there, and the dog, doesn't do what I'm doing but comes and investigates that point, then he's doing something differently than I'm doing, but he's only doing it because I was looking there, and he assumed that there must be something interesting there, because otherwise, why would I be looking at it? So danger with anthropomorphism there, but that just comes with cognitive science. All right. And then the last thing I wanted to give a concrete example of is cache thieving behavior, and also cache, just general caching behavior. And so, like I said, caching, which is the thing you're reading about in Unit C, it is a really rich tool for studying behavior, learning, and even cognition. So this was a nice example with these scrub jays. And I won't go into all of the details here, but I talked before about how smart the thieves are, but also, how smart the hoarders have to be. So in this particular case, they give scrub jays the opportunity to bury food in laboratory setups in one of two conditions, either while they're being observed by other birds or not. And when they're in the trays that have observers, then the scrub jays will frequently bury their stuff, and then they'll go back, and then they'll pick it up and they'll rebury it. And they'll do that over and over again. But if they have no observers, then they just bury it once. So, what does that mean? One story there is that there is a theory of mind where the scrub jay that's being observed has a theory that the scrub jays that are observing it are going to remember where it buried it and then come back and then steal its food later. So if it buries it in multiple places, it makes it harder for the other scrub jays to observe. And then maybe it also just checks to see if it's still there. So then if it is, then it moves it, kind of like changing its password over and over, every month or something like that. So that is another way we can assess theory of mind. So a bunch of different tools to assess these things. As I was kind of asked in the beginning, these are a set of problems that have generally been listed as hallmarks of cognition. And a lot of behavioral experiments try to chase down these problems. How well do animals do each one of these things? I left out the hermit crab that I wanted to talk about at the very beginning of it, but I'll leave it out for time. In general, the key thing about cognition is these internal mental states. But this is not an exhaustive list. There are many more examples of how you can chase down cognition. So, any other questions about that? If not, I'll let you ruminate over questions, and I'll close with this one here. So, a question here, gaze following. If I do the behavioral assay gaze following with an animal, what am I trying to assess if the animal has? Self-recognition, theory of mind, or mental time travel? Otherwise, we'll see you Tuesday. Have a good weekend. All right.